All right. Well, this is Dan, and you're probably going to notice that Joe wasn't the first one talking like he usually is. Joe's actually not here today. His wife is having him celebrate her birthday with him today. So it's Tessa's birthday, and so we're going to excuse Joe today. But we've actually brought in an upgrade. We've brought Kyson, the local legend Kyson Montague here, which is a super treat. I've been wanting to have Kyson on for a long time. Kyson is a guy that I would just love to do a road trip with because we could geek out about training the entire time and I would just never get bored. So Kyson, you want to say hi?
Hey, I'm super happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for being here. And Kyson will kind of fill in for Joe on the world and national cycling scene, something that I am never as up to speed on as I should be. I kind of have my blinders on a certain focus mostly, but Kyson's more up to steam on that stuff. So he'll help cover that in Joe's place. But first of all, we had the Cactus Hugger race yesterday that both of us were at. What'd you think about that race?
Man, it was hot. It was a really hot race.
It was brutal hot. Like, I'm still wearing a jacket when I ride around home occasionally, but it was like, how hot did it get? Like 85 or something?
Yeah, mid 80s. I felt really jealous of the racers that raced in the first wave that had like the nice 50 to 60 degrees, but that second wave got really hot.
Yeah, it felt like 90. It felt like it was in the 90s just because it was such a shock, but it was definitely one of the best turnouts we've ever had to an iCup race. It was so cool to see that many Maybird racers there. It was just awesome. A lot of fun. I was just so stoked to have that many. Like those pink skin suits just looked awesome out there.
They pop. Yeah, you definitely can notice them when they're in a group. There was a lot of them out there this weekend.
Yeah. But yeah, and I'm hoping that, so Cactus Hugger is going to be the next iCup. I'd really like to get more girls out to that race.
Yeah.
We had quite a few girls out, but not quite enough. So girls, if you're listening, let's make sure we're out to Three Peaks and do that one. That's probably my favorite iCup. So I'm hoping we get a really good crowd out to that one. But yeah. One thing I was going to say was going to talk just, this is just kind of a sidebar a little bit. We had a lot of flat tires.
Yeah. There were a lot of flat tires, mainly in the second half. Like that, the end of that downhill's got a little bit of chunky rocks in there.
Yeah. And I actually did, let me pull it up here real quick. I did a little survey. Let's see how I pause this. Okay. I had to pause it for a second to figure out how to use the tech on this. Joe's not here and I really don't know what I'm doing. So hopefully this is even like recording something. But I did a little survey to all the people that got flats at the race just to see if we could kind of learn anything from their experience. And Kyson and I were just kind of looking over these results real quick. But so I have a theory on people that get flats at races. Cause I'm about to jinx myself, but I don't get very many flats.
Oh, you better knock on wood.
I know. Like, but my first question was, how long before the race did you check your tire pressure? I have this theory that like a lot of the kids that like, you know, that smack the rim and get flats, like didn't check their pressure. Mm-hmm. But according to the survey of those that got flats, 25% didn't, 75% did. I think a few people might be lying, but my feelings on tire pressure, and Kyson, jump in and share yours, but I usually try to go as low as you can go without ever hitting the rim. Like if you're hitting the rim, it's too low. If you're not hitting the rim, it's fine.
Certainly. I've kind of from some of the national races, I've heard people say that one rim ping a lap is just right. Like if it's only hitting once, you're okay. But if it's hitting more than once, you need a little bit more pressure.
Yeah. Because once you understand like rolling resistance and how the tire conforms over changes in the pavement and so forth, you realize that low pressure is faster. it's something we're just kind of learning. It's like the 40, 50 year old dads are used to the 40 pound mountain bike tire pressures, but we know better now. But seemed like most of the kids were running, I would almost say a little high, like Miles kept it pretty low. But other than that, most people were in the 20s, 22, 25, which is more than I run, and I weigh more than these kids, you know, so.
Certainly. I'm weighing about 170 pounds, and I was running 18, 19 PSI for this one. So it's really good on all the climbs. There's one kind of really big rock garden section near the end that you can really slap a rim on if you're not careful. But for the most part, having lower PSI would be much better on this course.
Yeah. And I run inserts, and I run mine. I weigh more than Kyson, surprise everyone. But I run mine below 20 and usually don't have a problem. Yeah. But maybe I don't get after it as much as some of these kids either, too. But,
yeah, there's some senders in there.
Yeah. So this was my next question is, how do you check the tire pressure? Because I think that a lot of kids, to check their tire pressure, they stick their thumb on top of the tire and push down, and depending on how hard it is to push down, they determine if their tire's fine or not, which I have found to be very inaccurate. I'm really not good at checking pressure this way, but supposedly out of everyone that got a flat, none of them checked their tire that way. So I'm sure someone's lying, but the next question, and another one of my theories on maybe why we had so many flat tires is, it seems like when tires are more than a season old, they get brittle. And, you know, a brittle tire, if it hits a rock and hits the rim or whatever, is more likely to pinch and break. It looks like about 60% of these that got flats actually had new tires this season, which kind of surprised me. About 40% didn't, were from last year.
Yeah, I'd be curious what tires they were running, you know?
Like, I know, I should have asked that. Yeah, that's probably what I should have asked, but I... the next question is if they were running old tires, when did they check their sealant last? And 25% of those that got a flat haven't checked it yet this season.
Yeah, there's so probably no sealant left in those tires.
I guarantee there's no sealant left in those tires. So that one wasn't too surprising. But anyhow, like, I guess my point is, you know, like, why do you think, like, Keegan never gets flats? Is it because he gets new tires every single race? Probably,
but Keegan's also, in a lot of cases, running probably lower tire pressure than most people, and he's usually running, you know, like an Aspen with, you know, max speed casing. Like, he's running light, fast tires that are probably more likely to flat than most of us are running.
You think he's just has more finesse?
I would guess it's probably comes down to finesse. I know that he does so much testing with all of his races, like with his tires, with what inserts he's doing, like the tire pressure. You look at like his prep for Leadville last year, he tested every single tire possible, and he ended up going with the Exo casing instead of the Max Speed casing for the Aspen, something with a little bit more of a sidewall protection, which I think most people are probably expecting him to do the Max Speed casing. So I think, you know, a lot of it is just testing, knowing your equipment. And
I just barely ordered some Max Speed Aspens just right before you. I should have thought you first.
Oh, I love my Max Speeds. Okay. I was using Max Speeds this weekend, so they're great tires for sure.
You know, it's funny. Miles Baker got a flat towards the end and ended up riding a wheelie for a lot of that final climb.
Yeah.
To finish the race. And he was like miles ahead and then got the flat. Someone caught him and had to finish the race doing a lot of wheelies and rolling on his rim, basically. But so.
That's such a bummer. He was having a great race.
He was having a fantastic race. So, yeah, so my advice would be, you know, don't let your tires get old. Take them to a bike shop, recycle them. They donate kind of used tires to, what's that place downtown? It's just slipping my mind. But
sure.
Yeah, like, don't run old tires. Tires are just such an easy way to be faster. Make sure you're checking your sealant and check your pressure before every ride. You know, you don't need too much, but you need enough, or else you're going to be smacking your rim and causing all kinds of problems. So, yeah, that's maybe just something to kind of work on. And yeah, I'm sure there's a solution to that. So
I would even make sure you're checking the tire pressure on the pre-ride as well. Like, that's your chance to see what tire pressure you want to run before the race. Throw in whatever PSI you're planning on running for the race in your pre-ride and see how it works. You know, if you go through and you do hit your rim on a rock in your pre-ride, maybe it's a sign that you should probably be running a little bit more pressure in your race.
Yeah, true. I think really you should check your pressure before every ride. You just never. Certainly. Yeah.
100%.
Yeah, so real quick, what do you think of those, the new Aspens? Well, I guess they're not new, but I guess we now have access to like Nino's Aspens.
And yeah, the Aspen ST. Yeah, they look super fast rolling. It kind of keeps the same knobs on the side, so theoretically you still get the cornering of the regular Aspen, but more of a file tread down the middle, a little bit faster. I mean, it's the tire that Keegan's now won 3 Sea Otter Classics on as of this weekend, so it looks like it's a pretty fast tire.
Would you ever run that?
Oh, I'd love to. I can't wait to throw a set on.
Do you think they last very long?
You know, you're moving up to the 170 TPI on those ones, so they definitely are going to last a lot. They won't last quite as long. I'd guess maybe half life, if not a little less. It's kind of one of those tires that you only throw on for race day, and you just kind of keep a set in your garage.
Yeah, it's probably true. But all right, well, let's talk a little bit about some maybe national and international cycling stuff we should be aware of. What's going on?
Certainly, there? Yeah. The elite men's race in Araxa is actually happening right now, so we don't have live results from that. But kind of from this weekend, the second round of the World Cup down in Brazil, we've had Team USA absolutely crushing it. Riley Amos and Bjorn Riley in the U23 men's race have been killing it. Riley won the short track and then proceeded to win the cross-country race. Christopher Blevins has been doing absolutely great. He rode to second place in the short track, led out his teammate Victor Kretzky for the win. So,
oh, wow.
Specialized boys have been on top of it. Haley Batten, a Utah native, actually won both of the races. She won the short track race yesterday, and as of this morning, she just won the XCO race ahead of Jenny Risveds.
Oh my goodness, that is so cool.
Fantastic
racing. That is awesome news.
Yeah, it was a really exciting last couple of laps in the women's race. They almost came to a standstill at one point as they were trying to fight over who was going to enter the single track first to get the draft advantage. Like, there were so many tactics going on, very different than the race from last week.
So they were fighting over who got second into the single track, right?
Exactly. Okay. Yeah, there was a kind of a long downhill section followed by, you know, kind of this more of a flat rolly section where there was a pretty big draft advantage. So nobody wanted to go into the final descent first because then the second place person would draft off of them in the section after the downhill. So,
you know, I really think that the youth cyclists listening to this and the adults too really do need to watch some World Cups, because I think that is the best way to really learn cross-country race tactics. Because, like, who's better at it than these guys and gals? You know,
certainly.
Like,
yeah,
it's such a good place to learn race tactics. And yeah,
fitness can only get you so far. Like, in last week's race, Haley Batten was probably the strongest racer in the field. She tried to attack Jenny Risveds over and over on the last lap, but Jenny had the better tactics and won the race because of it.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think it seems like it's getting more and more strategical too. Like, it's
certainly,
people are getting smarter and it's becoming a little more civilized, a little more yeah, just tactics are mattering more and more, I think, in this sport. So
100%. And even this weekend at, you know, the local iCup races, I mean, it's very different than a World Cup, but the first single track on this iCup course is extremely hard to pass on. And, you know, the positioning into that first single track played a really big part in what position riders were in for the first, second, and even third laps, because all just because of that first single track and the inability to pass later on.
Yeah, and it was one of those courses, too, where, like, drafting mattered. You know, it gets windy out there, and you know, if you're in a group, you've just got a huge advantage than if you have to, like, be out there alone. And, yeah, tactics do matter.
Certainly. Yeah. It's not just for the World Cup racers, like even for us normal people, at the Utah local races.
Yeah, for sure. Well, that's awesome, man. That's super cool. I should point out that Kyson had no idea he would be covering the national and international news, but he just is ready for that. And so, that was awesome. Well, was there anything else? Or is, you think that?
Some of the U23 women for the U.S. Did really well. Madigan Monroe was up there throwing punches in the first couple laps. They finished just off the podium, so not quite as spectacular, but to still be up in the top 10 at a World Cup level event is insane. So Team USA has really elevated the game this year.
That's so awesome. Think of how many of those key players are former NICA riders.
I think pretty much all of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so this is so cool to be part of. Well, I'm just so excited to have Kyson here today. I just love the Montague family. I remember I was helping ride with our Gold Girls group a lot of years back, and there was this cute little girl that came that was just like the friendliest little girl ever, and she was just like all these girls were like super shy, but this one girl was just like going out of her way to like talk to everybody and make friends with everyone. And that was Lauren Montague. And I'm like, this girl is just the nicest girl ever. And then I got to know her parents, and her parents are just awesome, awesome people. I love, like, Ken Montague is like my bud. He's so fun to talk to about bikes. He's just such a bike nerd, and he just knows the scene inside and out. He's just always so in the know. He's just such a great resource. So I just love the family. And Kyson is just like such an awesome example of what you guys can achieve post Nike if you keep riding. And I just think it's so cool what he's doing. But why don't you, I love your story. And your dad's told me your story. I've never heard your version of the story, but it's such a cute little Nike story. And you want to tell that real quick?
Sure, yeah. I had a much different start than to cycling than the majority of the people that are still racing today kind of in my group. I started racing when I was 15 years old with my freshman year of high school. So I didn't race in middle school. I didn't do any BMX. I didn't do any of these other things that a lot of the people that are kind of at my level did when they were growing up. Starting my freshman year, I was coming out of playing football, Little League football, and I was this kind of little bit of a chubby freshman that had never been on a bike before.
And I'm sitting across from him right now, and I can't picture the chubby thing.
It was a much different Kyson back then. Luckily, the head coach of the Corner Canyon mountain bike team at the time, Whitney Pogue, was one of my neighbors, and is still one of my idols today, but
she's an awesome lady. I love her. She's just so great.
Certainly.
I think so much for the cycling community.
She's probably responsible for putting more kids on bikes than anyone I know.
Mm-hmm. That's safe to say for sure.
Yeah. So she, kind of coming out of this football era, I was looking for something else to do in high school, and Whitney recommended the mountain bike team. And I kind of just went into it not really knowing what to expect. I did our time trial up the Orson Smith Fire Road, and I was like, I think I was the second slowest person on the entire team. Like, Corner Canyon's known to be the super fast team. I was probably the slowest male athlete my freshman year. I got put in the lowest ride group at some of the first races. I was like 20, 25 minutes back behind the winner of the freshman races. So,
that's interesting you say that. And I just want to throw this out there just in case this means anything to anyone. But when I think of all of Maybird's fastest pink boys right now, almost all of them actually started out in our slowest group.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, my first ever race was at Powder Mountain. And I remember I went out and pre-ride the course with my dad, and I had made a wrong turn, and I actually got put onto the varsity loop there, which is a little bit more rocky.
Yeah, it's pretty chunky, section up there. It's super fun, though.
But I had no idea at the time. I thought that was part of my race course. and I couldn't keep my feet. I wasn't in clips. I couldn't keep my feet on the pedals, on the rocks. I was just getting bounced around. I had to like hike the entire section. And I remember getting back to the car and like crying to my dad that like this was too hard, that I needed clips if I was going to be a good rider, because I couldn't keep my feet in the pedals. And this bike racing thing was just so hard. It was too much for me to do. So I've definitely come a long way since then. You know, my sophomore year, I got a little bit more into it. I did like a winter spin class and got the fitness up a little bit more.
Tell us real quick about the bike you started out on.
My parents got me like maybe a $500 bike from Scheels. It was like this 30-pound hybrid Trek. I think it was like a dual sport. No, dual sport's too lightweight. It had to have been something heavier than that. So there was something wrong with the seat post. Like, it kept slipping down on all of my rides. So like, I was always the kid that was like riding the seat post at the lowest possible position with my knees just fully bent. I looked like such a Jerry.
And I love when your dad tells this, was telling me, he's like, you know, and Whitney came to me and she's like, you know what? You got to get Kyson a better bike. And he's like, what? I spent $600 on this bike.
If only he knew now, like, what we're spending for bikes these days.
Yeah, he's probably spent that on handlebars now.
Oh, certainly. Yeah, no, that first year I actually rode on a loaner bike from Whitney. Like, the team has a handful of loaner bikes that they give out to a couple of the kids. And that first year I was on a Specialized Crave, it was a Pitch. Just a really low-end, like, aluminum cross-country bike. So it was definitely a step up from the Trek, but it was still a pretty entry-level bike for sure.
So, like, what happened? You know, like, when?
I kind of fell in love with it and fell in love with getting better. For the first couple of years, like, it was very social for me. A lot of my friends did the mountain bike team, and, you know, I wanted to be faster because I wanted to just go out and ride with my friends. And those first couple of years, it was all just about, you know, going and riding and having fun. Kind of when I got into my junior year, I co-signed with a loan from my parents to get a new bike. most 16-year-olds, they go for a new car on their 16th birthday. I got this brand new full suspension bike. I was really into it at the time, and I wanted to do better. So I rode all summer long, and at the first race of the year, I rode to a podium position in the JV boys category, which was fantastic. Up until then, I had been back in like the 20s. Freshman year, back in the 60s and 70s. So being up in the top five was an incredible feeling. And, you know, once I saw the front of a race, I've been hooked on it ever since, you know, chasing that same feeling. I want to win races now. Mm-hmm. I want to be up at the front and be competitive. And so it's kind of changed from social motivation to, you know, always trying to go out and be my best self and get better and faster on my bike.
That's awesome. What has been like kind of the highlight of your racing career? Like, what part of it, I guess, would brought you the most joy?
That's a hard question, because I find so much joy in different aspects of the sport. I think right now, like, you know, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, it was more social, hanging out with my friends. And, you know, a year or two ago, it was probably more result based. I think what I find the most joy in right now is helping other people, you know, kind of experience cycling the same way that I did. You know, in a lot of those early years, I felt like kind of stuck almost. Like, I wanted to get better, but I wasn't 100% sure how to get better. You know, I'd go up to my ride leaders after practice and be like, you saw me ride, like, what can I do? Like, what can I work on? And I wanted to get better, but I didn't know how. And so I think right now what brings me the most joy in the sport is helping that person that I was 5, 6 years ago, helping them to get better, because they probably feel just as stuck as I used to.
You know, I can totally relate to that answer, because I get joy the same way. I mean, I just love, that's what Maybird's about basically, is helping these kids, you know, because you never know, like, who the next Kyson is going to be. You know, this kid that's kind of showing up to race in a backpack and, you know, and sneakers and flat pedals, and, you know, that kid could one day be a Kyson. You know, you just really, and that's one thing I've never really been good at predicting, who is just going to really fall in love with this and who's going to just run with it and make it part of their life. You know, you just really never know. And, I think it's just cool, like, giving people that opportunity, you know,
100%.
Cause yeah, you know, here we have Kyson sitting in front of me, you know,
right. I think in a lot of cases, it's hard to see the heart as well. Like that freshman that's showing up in the basketball shorts and you're like, dude, you should really like get some padded shorts. They're pretty cool. But you don't know that kid might fall in love with it. And, you know, if you don't show them the same time and love and, you know, help them to get better, they're always going to stay that kid. Cause that's who I was. It wasn't until other people kind of helped me to understand, you know, what I needed to do to get better that I actually started to improve. Like, I'd still be in basketball shorts if one of my ride leaders didn't tell me that I should probably get some basketball, something other than basketball shorts. So,
yeah, that's awesome. No, so Kyson's a busy guy. Why don't you talk about, like, he's going to school. First of all, tell us a little bit about your schooling, what you're going into. Also, Kyson is, as many of you know, Kyson does some coaching. He coaches several Maybird athletes and other athletes. He's going to school. He's working at a bike shop. Tell us, I'm amazed you have time to train as much as you do. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what you got going on right now?
Yeah, it's definitely a pretty busy schedule. I guess on the coaching side first, you know, I had some great Maybird riders that I coached that did really well this weekend. You know, definitely lots of shout outs there. One of the top ones is Emma Daly. Got so close to winning her category in the JV girls. She had an amazing race, and so many others did too. But I've kind of started coaching freshman year of college, and, you know, I kind of created this little company, Montague Coaching, that I've kind of been running with ever since and growing. And it's definitely been a lot of work to do that on top of everything else that I'm doing at the moment, but it's been a lot of fun. So I've definitely enjoyed the coaching side a lot.
Yeah. And let me just throw out there that his kids are doing great. Like they're good kids. They're having fun. They're showing up to lots of the races. They're really involved in the local cycling community, and they're doing awesome. So you're doing something right.
It's been a lot of fun, and, you know, fun's a very important part of, you know, progressing in this sport. So outside of the coaching, I've been working at a bike shop since I was 15, to help pay for this stupid expensive sport that we are a part of. So I started, at the Hangar 15 over in Draper when I was, 15 years old, and I'm still there now, and I've been working there, ever since. I graduated in 2020 from Corn Canyon and immediately started pursuing an exercise, physiology degree up at the University of Utah. I'm about halfway through it now. To be honest, I don't love the academic side of school. Like, I'm definitely was more of a social creature in high school, but now that I've kind of gotten to the point with my college courses where, you know, it is more based around the thing that I want to study, you know, the human body, training, how those two go hand in hand, I've definitely enjoyed it a lot more. So I'm technically a senior up there now. I did take a gap year this year to kind of focus on, you know, training and working and everything else that's going on, but I'll be back up there in the fall again.
That's so awesome. Well, good luck with that. That's part of why you're here. He's had a lot of experience as a rider racer. He races on a really high level. He's racing U23 right now at the national level and doing really well. Worked with a lot of kids, been around a lot of riders. I thought he would be a good one to bring in to kind of talk about maybe just some lessons you've learned either kind of from yourself or through working with other people. And just maybe, like, I thought we could, it'd be kind of fun to point out some common pitfalls that we probably should try to avoid as athletes. And we can kind of discuss some of those. So I thought that would be kind of a fun thing to bring Kyson in to talk about, because I think he'd be a really good resource for that. So, so what are you thinking along those lines?
Well, the first one that kind of comes to mind, you know, common pitfalls that a lot of people fall into. I think a lot of riders do their zone two rides, like their easy rides, too hard.
Can I just think? Can I just say thank you right now?
It's such a common mistake. It's probably the most common mistake.
I was hoping you would say that. Yeah. Okay, but go on. Sorry, I just got the chills all of a sudden. Like,
100%.
Okay, yeah. Go on. Sorry, I just got excited.
Something that I definitely started noticing once I got more into the coaching side of things is there's a lot of riders that take their zone 2 days, and they're, whether it's from impatience or whether it's just from wanting to go out and smash a climb or just go have, you know, maybe their buddy rode by them, they want to go catch up. There's so many riders that treat their zone 2 rides, their endurance days, like their zone 3 days. And, you know, in over the course of, you know, a week's training, let's say there's a rider doing an endurance zone 2 day on Monday, and then we have scheduled a hard, like, 8-minute interval day on Tuesday. And that's the day that we're going to boost their FTP. You know, that's the day that I want them to be at their 100% and really push their legs to progress. But the problem is that that rider on Monday on their easy zone 2 day, they decided that they were going to ride a little bit above zone 2. They turn it into a zone 3 day. And now on Tuesday, when they go to do those hard intervals, they can only do them at 90% of what they could have done before, and they're not getting the full benefit. And, you know, you see that kind of, they do that multiple times throughout the week, and suddenly the quality of their training has gone down significantly because they weren't hitting the numbers that we wanted them to hit on the actual hard days. You know, it's like going too hard in your warm-up and then not doing the intervals correctly.
Yeah. Or like going too hard on your warm-up and not doing very well at the race, you know? I mean, it's
100%.
Yeah. God, my mind's just going a million different directions right now with this, just because you've really hit a nerve. I've been thinking a lot about this lately. I almost think that, like, for most athletes, a zone two ride, and you can't see my air quotes I'm using right now, that can mean just about anything. That I think it, for most kids, it kind of means anything that's not their absolute hardest is a zone two ride.
Right.
Yeah. Anything below that zone two, anything above that's rate pace. And it's not, no, there's a huge chasm between those two.
100%.
You know, I think it's not so much that they do like tempo rides. I think their zone two rides are really zone 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 rides.
Yeah.
Just randomly, you know, and I think you can actually do a zone two ride on a lot of trails, not all trails, but it just takes a lot of discipline, you know, and I think that a lot of people think that if they go out for a ride, if they're not giving it all, their all, they're wasting their time. They're wasting valuable training time. And that's something I think we need to get over.
Totally. Yeah. And even just looking at it from the physiology point of view, your body needs that zone two time to perform at its best. You know, a lot of people talk about fitness is, you know, you have to build the foundation with zone two, especially in the early season, the base season. A lot of the riders that I work with, I'll even give them like a heart rate cap for their early season rides. For those zone two rides, you know, I'll say don't go over 140 beats per minute. And that's pretty hard to do, like, especially early season. Like, if I go up a climb, even if it's a small hill, I can go over 140 beats per minute. Like, it's not an easy thing to do. But, you know, after you do that for 1 week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, you might notice that suddenly you can go up that hill and keep under the 140 beats per minute. Like, it's definitely a system that you have to train, and it helps train the body so that when you do, you know, get later into the season, you do start doing the harder, the VO2s, the thresholds, you notice that you're able to repeat those efforts a lot more, and you feel a lot better doing them because you actually did your zone two rides and you actually built the correct base for the season.
You know, one thing, like, I think most people, when they ride, before they start getting into more like formal training or whatever, they kind of like, they enjoy riding on the flats, and they kind of dread if there's going to be another climb or another hill, and then the flats feel really good, but then they dread that there's another climb coming because they have to work harder on a climb. And like, in theory, if you're doing it right, you shouldn't dread the climbs, because you back off the power enough that those should feel about as hard as the flats, you know? Yeah. I always joke that a power meter actually makes your climbs easier, because, you know, if you're trying to keep your power at, let's say, 180 watts, that's going to feel kind of hard on a flat, but that's going to feel pretty easy on a climb.
Certainly.
You know, so power meters make hills easier, you know. But yeah, I think this is just super important. And I think, and it's kind of like a double whammy, you know, benefit, because it benefits you, because really that's how you train those systems, those aerobic, fat burning, slow twitch systems. It just takes time. You go above it, you're training something else, you know. That's one part of it. But the other part of it is, if you're doing those workouts too hard, you're sacrificing quality of your key important workouts that like make you race fast.
100%.
You know, so, and it's kind of a triple whammy too, because if you're doing hard, air quotes, zone two rides, and then kind of weak sauce interval days, the combination almost just kind of leads to stagnation and overtraining.
Certainly. You're also not getting the right recovery as well. You know, like, you'll probably have to throw in a recovery day after one of those interval days, but you just turned, you know, an easy day and a hard day into two mediocre days. You didn't really recover the way you were supposed to over the course of those days either. So now we're overtraining, we're not recovering the way we should, and you sacrificed, you know, what could have been 100% effort on those intervals for 90%, and now you're not progressing.
Yeah. It's, you know, I mean, it's okay to a point. It gets you to a point. But once you want to get to that next level, this is super important.
Certainly.
You know, I mean, to a certain point, just riding your bike is going to get you faster, you know. But once you start getting to that point and you stagnate, this is when this becomes really important, when you can want to get from that top 10 JVA to the podium JVA kind of thing. You know, this is super important. Here's something I want you to think about for a sec, because this is something I've been kind of wondering. Okay, you know how, like, at least for you and I, we can tell we're in zone two if we can carry on a slightly interrupted conversation? Yeah. You know, it's like you can carry on a conversation, but it's not easy. You know, it's a little, you kind of have to stop everyone. Like, someone else could tell you're exercising if you were talking to them on the phone, you know?
Exactly. Yeah.
Do you think that's true for kids?
With kids, it's hard, because I think when kids are talking, when they're in a social group, I think that a lot of the times they'll talk even when they're in threshold. Like, they just get so excited to be social, and especially if it's with their buddies, they can talk when they're at tempo. They can talk when they're at, you know, threshold. So I think it depends on the rider for sure, but I've seen a lot of kids talking through threshold intervals that I was, you know, huffing and puffing.
Yeah, me too. I'm almost starting to think that that's a good test for adults, but not necessarily for kids.
Certainly. Yeah.
How would you describe what a zone two ride should feel like for a youth athlete if they're not using power or heart? Like, what, like, how would you describe how that should feel for those that are kind of low tech?
Yeah, it's,
which is good, which is fine.
Totally. Yep. It is totally
the more
okay.
I do this, the less tech I get.
So. Right. Yeah. I think a normal zone two ride, I think that's normally a pace that you can hold for, let's say, 6 to 8 hours. You know, like, it is a really conservative pace. In a lot of the cases, I think most people, if they're questioning whether they're going too hard, they probably are going too hard. You know, generally like your zone one, your recovery pace is usually in your granny gear.
It's ridiculously easy.
Super easy.
Like you shouldn't even wear a kit to do it.
No. Yeah, exactly. That's a neighborhood spin is your zone one. So for the most part, if you're going out and adding any torque, like if you're pedaling at any gear other than your granny gear, you're usually not in recovery zone. You're usually in an endurance zone. So, I mean, there's low and high endurance. Like, you can definitely be pushing a little bit harder and still hold that pace for, you know, 6 hours, like, you know, kind of a longer zone two effort. But I think for the most part, if you're nose breathing and you're able to hold a conversation and you're just out enjoying it, you're probably in zone two.
How tired should you be after, like, a two-hour zone two ride?
I would say usually not that tired. I think it depends on, you know, the rider's current level of fitness, how much they're riding. I mean, if you're only doing 1 hour rides every day and you go out and do a 2 to 3 hour zone two, you're probably going to feel a little bit more tired. But mm-hmm. I think any lasting fatigue over a 2 to 3 hour endurance day is maybe a reflection more of what the athlete's eating during their ride than necessarily the effort that it is to hold the zone two pace.
For sure. Yeah. So, yeah, and I always kind of describe it, you know, you should feel like you got a workout. It should feel like a workout, but you shouldn't feel it the next day.
100%.
Like if you go to ride the next day and your legs are tired from your zone two ride before the day before, it wasn't a zone two ride the day before. So
totally. Yeah.
You know, and let me just throw it, like, it's okay to just go out and hammer and have fun every once in a while with your friends. You know, that's totally fine. But if you're wanting to get to that next level and taking your training seriously, that shouldn't be every ride you do, you know.
For sure. I think there's room for that within a structured plan as well. Like with a lot of the riders that I coach, you know, they might be doing, you know, schemo or track or, you know, theater. They might have other things in their life as well that they need to attribute. And, you know, be it, you know, let's take a day off the bike to go do a track or a schema workout, or even if it's, hey, I want to go smash with my friends. Okay, let's do a 3 hour free ride workout where I'm not going to give you any structure. You go treat the day however you want. Like if you want to do zone two all day, you're welcome to. If you want to go do some intervals or you want to go smash KOMs with the buddies, yeah. I think that's a really important part of training plan.
Yeah, you know, I think sometimes, like on those days you're just feeling awesome, you know, sometimes it's good just to take advantage of that and go feel awesome and do awesome things. But again, it shouldn't just be like the default workout, you know, but
totally. I definitely think that you have to have a good mix of everything, you know, not every day is a fun day, especially on days that your legs hurt. You know, I think that that's an area where structured training is really important. Is there's definitely those days where you wake up and you're like, I do not want to ride my bike today, but coach gave me a 2 hour endurance day, so I'm going to go ride my bike and it might not feel the greatest, but I'm going to keep progressing. I'm going to keep getting better.
Okay. Well, that was a good one. I'm glad you covered that one because that would have been mine. I mean, it's just I'm guilty of it myself and I think a lot of people are, but I think that's it's good to hear it from you as well as me.
I also think that a lot of riders, especially in high school, need to not be afraid to be vocal with their ride leaders as well. If the scheduled ride is a zone two endurance day and your ride leader is going too hard, it's totally okay to voice that to the ride leader and say, hey, we probably need to back it down, because sometimes it's hard for the ride leader to know where that pace is for their riders.
Well, exactly, because I'm riding, like, I'm substituting for Andrew because he busted his arm really bad. And I'm riding with this group of really fast, shout out guys. They are really fast kids. And I always worry that I'm boring them or, you know, that they want to be going faster. So I kind of feel a little to push maybe a threshold for me, assuming it's only a zone two for them. But I think that's a really good point to bring up, that if it is a zone two ride and if it's an endurance pace ride, that you should probably vocalize that to the ride leader. And
certainly, and,
you know, I mean, really a zone two ride shouldn't be slinking too much and spreading out and breaking up, you know, like I think most people in that group should be able to stay together pretty well if it's a zone two ride, and there should be conversation going on and, Yeah, that's a really good point.
Yeah. Yeah, if you're group ride, if you're having to sprint out of every corner at the very end of the group, it's probably a little bit too fast.
Yeah.
But
well, that okay. I that was a good one.
Yeah. Probably next one on my list, not getting caught up in the new bike equipment that comes out every year.
Oh, interesting.
I think it's super, and this not necessarily new equipment, but I think a lot of people think, you know, if I get this, I'm going to be faster. If I get the new carbon wheel set, I'm going to win my next race. If I get on a power meter, I'm finally going to be better than so-and-so, or I'm going to make the podium, or, you know, if I have those new glasses that Matthew Vanderpool wore this weekend, like, I'm going to be Matthew Vanderpool.
Like, the new scalpel just came out, so I'm so self-conscious about being on last year's,
you know, right? It's just... There's nothing wrong with your current scalpel, but there's just that feeling, like, oh, I got to get on that new bike.
Okay, because, like, when you think about it, like, what technology has come out recently within the past 2 or 3 years that would make you significantly faster on a mountain bike?
I mean, I definitely think there's been a lot of innovations that have come out, but at the same time, even at the highest level of the sport, you see exceptions to the rule all of the time. You see people that win races without power meters. You see people who don't have the new flight attendant electronic suspension win races. You see people that don't have the latest and greatest fanciest stuff still winning races. I think it's even more pronounced at the high school level, like at the NICA races. You sometimes see people on those like state podiums that are on just the worst bikes you've ever seen. And you're like, how did he do that on that bike? But I think in a lot of cases, it's more of the rider than it is the bike.
I mean, I think there's like a minimum acceptable bike standard that needs to be, but it's not S-Works.
For sure.
You know, like, you know, I think there's like a point where a bike probably weighs too much, or, you know, maybe they need to get on clip pedals and have some actual bike shoe. You know, I think there's some certain things that need to be done, but really, like, you can be a state champ and you don't have to be on a $10,000 bike to do it.
100%. I think that there's definitely a few staples. I think clips are super important. I think having a dropper post is very important, although not super necessary.
Especially for Nika.
I mean, most of those courses you could race on a gravel bike.
Yeah.
So I think 1x12 drivetrains, like the just a 1x system in general, super efficient. I definitely am a big
tubeless
fan.
Tubeless tires,
100%. So I definitely, there's some staples, like some innovation that you probably should have. I'm not going to say it's necessary to win races, but I think most people should at least have a couple of those boxes checked. But beyond that, you probably don't need the new $10,000 bike to go win the race. You're probably just fine on your current bike.
Yeah, I agree. I think, you know, we're both kind of nerds into the physiology thing and the training side of it. And it is amazing how concerned some of these kids are about some of the latest, greatest technology and don't even care about like training principles or,
you know. Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if you really think that having a power meter is going to make you the next greatest thing, you're probably not really focused on that. You know, the people with power meters are probably doing more training than you. Like, if you're trying to compare yourself, like, oh, so-and-so has a power meter, he's so much better, or so-and-so has this bike, you should probably also be checking their Strava to see how much they're riding. 100%. I think that's probably more telling of their fitness and their results than the fanciest, latest, greatest things that they have on their bike.
I couldn't agree more. I think that's a really good one you've brought up. I like that. And I think it's probably good for parents to hear, because I think parents like to see their kids succeed, and you know, and they're probably worried that they need to go buy a $13,000 S-Works for their kids to be able to be competitive. But I think there's a lot better low-hanging fruit out there that is getting missed majorly.
100%. like the bike that I rode on a Fazari Signal Peak, which was about, I think mine was about 26 pounds in high school. And I rode that all through my junior and varsity years. And I was able to get up close to the top 10 and even on some podiums on a bike that most people would consider to be pretty heavy by cross country standards. And, you know, at the time it had 120 mils of travel and, you know, people were still on the fence of whether 100 mils was better or 120 mils was better. But I think that in a lot of cases, the rider makes so much more of a difference than having the latest, greatest.
It does. And another thing too, is just how well you take care of the bike you've got, you know, cause like my bike, I just love my bike to death. I honestly, because I was joking about like having the old version of the scalpel, but like, I just love my bike. It's just, but I take really good care of it. And I was just thinking the other day, I'm like, this thing just feels great, you know, and I just have so much fun. I can't imagine it being better, but I think a lot of that is because I really take good care of it too. You know, it really, that's a huge part of it. I've seen some really nice bikes that ride like garbage because they never get maintained. They never get serviced. They, you know, and then these parents might be thinking, oh man, we need the $12,000 bike right now because this $8,000 bike sucks, you know, but it just needs some love, you know.
Needs a little bit of love. And I also think it's really important to learn about your equipment. You know, we talked about earlier in this podcast about even just checking your PSI. Like, that's so surface level that making sure that you check your PSI before a ride, you should also be checking things like your suspension pressure. You should know what the rebound does on your shock. Like, if you know these extra things about your bike, you can kind of, you know, tweak it a little bit to make it feel a little bit better for you and ride better. Like, it's not necessarily that, you know, one rider has this new fancy bike. It might be that they're just more familiar with their equipment. They've learned it and it feels better to them because they actually have played around with the settings on the bike to make it feel best.
Yeah. That's a really good one. I wouldn't have thought of that one, but I'm so glad you brought that one up. That is really good. So do you have any others or?
I think there's probably one last one that I have, and that's don't forget to have fun with riding the bike. I think that that's something that a lot of people, especially when they start pursuing, you know, structured training or they're trying to get into a podium position or they're trying just to improve, I think a lot of people lose sight of the fun. And I think that that's not only just important to keep progressing, you know, if you ride as hard as you can all summer, but you have no fun, you're not probably going to ride over the winter and you might not even ride next year. You know, you might burn yourself out of it. But I think having fun is also a really important part of turning this into a lifelong sport and not just a high school or a senior year sport. You know, it's cool to be fast one year. It's even cooler to be fast over multiple years and to keep enjoying the bike.
Oh yeah, because a lot of this fitness that it takes years to develop, you know, like years and years and years, you know, like the conversion between fast and slow twitches can be like a 10-year process, you know.
Certainly.
And so it's really just a shame to have this just be a high school sport. You know, I'm really, really hoping this is something that people do through college, through their 20s, 30s, and so forth. But for me, it's just kind of such a win-win because like, When I'm coming home from work, I just can't wait to get on my bike because I actually, like if it had no health benefits whatsoever, I'd still want to do it, you know, but it also has so many like awesome benefits. I want to do it for that reason too. But if it can be something that you like look forward to, like training becomes kind of automatic, you know, if it's something that you just want to do it, you know, you're not having to force yourself every time you train to train, you know, it's just something you're doing whether you have to or not.
Totally. I think, you know, I talked a little bit about my journey earlier in the podcast about, you know, feeling stuck and wanting to, you know, progress. And at that time, it may sound a little goofy now, but I actually sent an Instagram DM to Christopher Blevins, Haley Batten, Kate Courtney, and Howard Grotz, who were, in my mind, the four fastest people in the U.S. at the time. And only a couple of them responded, But I kind of asked them, I said, hey, I'm a Nike racer. I'm a junior. I want to get faster on my bike. I want to do what you guys do. What do I need to do? Like, what's the secret? And a lot of them told me two things. Consistency, like go race as much as you can. Go have fun. Go ride your bike every day. The other thing that they said was to have fun while doing it. Fall in love with training and enjoying the process. The rest of it will sort itself out in time. But going and having fun and consistently just riding is going to mean so much more than chasing numbers or, you know, trying to go out and do big structured rides every day.
And we kind of, you kind of do hear a lot about, like, you know, make sure you're having fun. Like, so what does that actually kind of mean to you? Like, how, like, if you're not having fun, what are you doing wrong?
I think it's a hard question because it's so mental, a lot of it, like where you're at in the season. Like, you can go have 3 bad races in a row and say, I'm not having fun. Like, this sucks. And to be fair, like, that does suck.
That doesn't sound like fun. Yeah.
No, like, if I go flat out of 3 races, I'm not having a good time. But I think for me, when I'm talking about whether I'm having fun, is I tend to look at it from a season perspective. Like, I don't let one day or one week or one race define whether or not I'm having fun. Because there's going to be days where I wake up and it's raining outside, but and I'm going to go ride anyways, and I'm not going to probably have fun on that day. Like, I'm not going to have a good time. But at the end of the week or at the end of the month, when I look back and say, did I have fun? I want to make sure that the answer is always yes. And if the answer is not yes, then I probably need to change some things in my training. You know, maybe that's adding a little less structure and, you know, going out and just having fun with some friends. Maybe you need to lower the training volume a little bit. There's definitely things that you can do to bring the fun back into it. And I think that you should probably take a look at that, like week to week, month to month, season to season. Because if you're not having fun, you're not going to do this long term. And I think that that's a really important thing.
Oh, yeah, for sure. How important do you think the social aspect is for youth cyclists?
I think it's huge. I think in a lot of cases, it's usually what brings us into the sport in the first place. You know, a lot of us, when we are riding with a middle school team, a high school team, the social aspect is probably the first thing that we notice more so than the fitness. You know, even a lot of riders that start out just riding with their families and going out with a ride with their dad, maybe, like, that's kind of the first, that's what they learn about the sport, is the social aspect of it first. The fitness, that all comes later. I think in a lot of cases, the social aspect and the fun aspect are often tied together. And I think, at least for me, there's no funner day than going out and riding with a bunch of my friends.
And that's how I am too. I mean, I do like, and I think for training to be sustainable, there has to be lots of variety. You just can't go out and do the same thing, same trail, same, you know, by yourself every single day, or that's just not sustainable. But, you know, I like riding by myself sometimes, but my goodness, I just have so much more joy when I ride with other people.
Totally.
You know, it's just so much fun to, like, sometimes if they're a little better than me, that's fun. Sometimes if I'm a little better than them, that's rare, but, you know, but fun. But it's just fun to kind of have that variety. Like, so I do think that's super important. This has been fun. Our time's kind of flying. Yeah. But so I do have a couple quick questions for you.
Totally.
That I just kind of want to pick your brain on a little bit. Like, how much time do you think it takes for a high school athlete to be successful? And by successful, I mean, like, I think most of the kids listening have pretty high aspirations. We're talking like at least top varsity successful. How much time do you think that takes, and how much time is maybe too much?
Yeah, I guess time, when you're talking about time, like time spent on the bike.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I think it's really important to take a look at where the rider is right now and where the rider wants to be. You know, if you can take, you know, this is point A, this is point B, and we need to draw a line between the two. And that line is going to be our training plan. I think that you know, you probably want to hit some important races along the way. Like if your goal is to race varsity by senior year, we should probably try to do some varsity I-Cups maybe earlier in the season, like try to build up to it a little bit. And I think that maybe you're starting out with, I mean, it's so hard to tell because it depends on where the rider's coming from, but maybe like 8 to 12 hours a week. I think you can get really, really fast on 8 to 12 hours a week.
I agree.
For a lot of people, less. Like, you know, there's a specialized pro, Alex Wild, who he's well known. He actually became a pro cyclist after high school, which is pretty rare. Like most of the people that are pros today, they didn't get to that point.
And after I think high the school. Thing that's cool about him is his high school results were pretty mediocre.
Totally. Yeah. And he, you know, now he's doing more of the gravel and more of the endurance thing, so he's doing more 20-plus hour weeks. But for a very, very long time, he was like known as like Mr. 3-4 hour man. Like he did not ride longer than 3 to 4 hours a day because in his mind, his primary discipline was cross country and he was only doing 90-minute races. So I don't necessarily think you have to be pushing more than 15 hours a week to get really fast. I think that if you have the time to dedicate to a little bit more base work, a little bit more low zone two, you can definitely get really fast by doing a little bit of that, and that will inevitably bump the hours up a little bit, kind of closer to that 12 to 15 range. But you can get really, really fast off of 8 to 12 hours, and even sometimes less depending on what the athlete has going on in their life. You know, if you say an athlete's doing track, for example, and you're doing 2 track days a day, but then you're only getting 8 hours on the bike.
That's plenty.
You're doing a lot, actually.
Yeah. And I do think, because I think there's some kids out there that are considering kind of pushing the upper limits, you know, because you always hear people about in the 15 to 20 range, you know, but I think then if you're kind of getting into that range, your intensity discipline needs to be really strict, you know, like your easy rides truly need to be easy and you're just making them longer. And, you know,
totally.
I think if you try to increase the volume too much, but keep everything just as hard, it could be a little dangerous, you know. But
totally. Yeah. I think it's also important to keep your goals in mind with your training. Like it's super easy to get caught up in like I want to do 20 hour weeks. Like that's the thing that, you know, a lot of people take a look and they say, if I'm doing 20 hour weeks, I'll be fast. But then they're only doing an hour long Nike race. And you're like, really, if you brought it back to 12 hours a week and just hit 2 to 3 key intensity sessions a week, you'd probably have better results because you're not training for a 6 hour race. You don't need to do 20 hours a week. Yes, in some cases it can be beneficial, but for what your specific goals are, that's probably not the best way to train for what you want out of, you know, your riding experience.
Yeah. Yeah, I think for most kids, 15 is probably the upper end. For
most kids, 15 is probably just too high, you know? Like,
yeah, especially if they're not disciplining their, like kind of back to our mm-hmm. zone two conversation, you know, if all your workouts are somewhat hard and tiring, that could be a bit too much even.
100%. So. I mean, standard like periodized training generally goes off of an 80-20 rule. You know, 80% of your training is endurance and 20% of it is intensity. So if you're taking a look at, say you're doing a 15-hour week and 80% of that is not zone two, you're probably overtraining, mm-hmm. you know? So I think...
And the way I look at that 80-20 now, I used to look at it differently. I look at anything above zone two is that
20%. 100%. Yeah.
Yeah.
And
like honestly, I count zone three as the 20%.
Yeah. And that's why I think so many people don't train zone three anymore is because after zone two, all of it just gets cropped together. Like you probably, there's definitely a place for zone three training, but especially for these Nike racers, when they're doing like 8 to 12 minute climbs for these races, you probably should be training 8 to 12 minute zone four or zone or like shorter zone five intervals than long zone three intervals.
Mm-hmm.
So
especially as you get closer to target.
100%.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like with the kids I work with, we do some longer intervals, like farther out just to kind of touch all parts of their systems, you know. But yeah, you definitely, as it gets more specific, I think even a lot of those climbs are like 3 minutes, you know.
Exactly. Yeah.
I mean, if you can be fast for 3 minutes, you, you know, that's pretty specific, I think, to a lot of the climbs around here. And, but yeah, well, this has been really fun. I just love talking. Joe doesn't like talking about it. It's funny when I do it with Joe, you know, like he likes talking about the pro racers and all that stuff. And I almost just kind of tune it out when he's talking, and he probably tunes me out when I'm talking about training and stuff. So it's been fun to have a training nerd on. So
I'm definitely a cycling nerd.
But well, thanks so much for coming on. Love to have you back sometime. And yeah, if you want to reach Kyson, I guess Instagram's probably a good way to find him, or Strava, or you can reach me, or what, you know, Team Snap, not a hard guy to get a hold of. But thanks so much for coming out. Any closing words of encouragement or advice to our riders?
No, I think we definitely touched on a lot of things here. Yeah, I guess if you're trying to reach out to me, it's Kyson Montague on pretty much everything. So I'd be happy to talk to anybody that's interested about training or coaching, or, you know, really kind of anything. I know I definitely talked a little bit in this podcast about, you know, feeling stuck or early in the early years. And if you're kind of feeling in that same boat, definitely reach out. I'd love to help you kind of progress in this sport, because it's not always an easy thing to do.
No, it's definitely not. And again, I, you know, if there's a takeaway, I'd probably say, you know, keep your easy rides easy, and gosh darn it, have fun. Seriously, if you're not having fun, you're doing something wrong. And if you're not having fun, reach out to somebody. And I think it's probably good to find out why and figure out what needs to be adjusted. So, all right. Well, thanks, Kyson. And I'll try to figure out how to turn this thing off here.
Thanks a ton.